Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The through line for today is change. Fast change overseas, somewhat slower changes here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 11th of July. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. Say this for the Brits. Boy, when things go haywire over there, they go haywire in a big, bad hurry. The race for the leadership of the ruling Conservative Party, once expected to have drawn out until October in the wake of the Brexit vote, narrowed today to one. The outgoing, now somewhat sooner than he thought, Prime Minister David Cameron came out in front of number 10 Downing Street today to sing his successor's praises. Theresa May is her name.
She is strong, she is competent, she's more than able to provide the leadership that our country is going to need in the years ahead, and she will have my full support.
Our man in London, Stephen Beard, has this latest twist and turn in the Brexit saga.
Just 4 days into the leadership race, and lawmaker Angela Leadsom dropped her bid to become the next British Prime Minister. She said the UK economy could not afford a lengthy leadership campaign.
Business needs certainty. A strong and unified government must move quickly to set out what an independent United Kingdom's framework for business looks like.
But Leadsom had been a staunch advocate for Brexit. Theresa May, now Prime Minister in waiting, campaigned for the UK to stay in the EU. In a speech today, May insisted she would honour the result of the referendum.
I couldn't be clearer. Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it. There will be no attempts to remain inside the EU.
Brexit could take many forms, however. The UK could end up being only semi-detached from the EU. Leave campaigner and Conservative lawmaker Andrew Bridgen.
There's going to be a clear suspicion that Brexit's going to be severely watered down, and I think that's going to be completely unacceptable to a large proportion of our Conservative members of Parliament and our constituents.
Today's dramatic twist has shaved about 2 months off the process of exiting from the EU, but up to 2 years of intense negotiations still lie ahead before Britain and its European partners agree the terms of the divorce or separation. This could still get very messy. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Today's mergers and acquisitions news comes with an arm bar and a reverse naked choke, maybe a single leg takedown. And that's just from a quick Google of UFC terms, the Ultimate Fighting Championship, better known as UFC. It also goes by MMA, mixed martial arts. The organization has sold itself to a talent agency for a kind of amazing $4 billion. The deal with WME, IMG, and private equity giants, including Michael Dell, yes, that Michael Dell, is said to be the richest transaction for a sports organization ever. Gigi Duban has that story.
People in the mixed martial arts world put it like this. You're walking down the street and you come to four corners. On one corner, there are guys playing basketball. On another, there's soccer. The third corner has guys playing catch and...
And the fourth corner, there are two guys fighting. Which one are you going to watch?
Joe Favorito is a sports marketing consultant. He also ran a mixed martial arts league and sold it to UFC. The answer now more than ever, he says, is people are going to watch the fight. Part of that is human nature, but also Favorito says the UFC did all the right things to go mainstream.
Literally going state by state to make sure that people were educated enough to know that this wasn't kind of, you know, a blood sport anymore, that it had matured.
MMA was banned in many states. Now it's legal in all 50. And the UFC focused on getting more people to watch. Christian Vaccaro teaches sociology at Indiana University of Pennsylvania and wrote a book about mixed martial arts.
They drew heavily on reality entertainment television to promote the sport across several different networks.
From Spike TV to Fox Sports to subscriptions to online events. Brett Boyle, who teaches marketing and sports business at St. Louis University, says talent group IMG already has a strong digital presence. So it's no wonder it wants to steer UFC's growing millennial fan base toward its content. Because those millennials?
Not only is it a large group of people, but it's folks with spending power.
And that all adds up to a real sports knockout. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was all sunshine and light. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This has been, and it still is really, a long couple of days in the progress of social and economic and racial justice in this country. Since Baton Rouge and St. Paul and in Dallas, there have been marches and demonstrations all over the United States. And it used to be that one of the symbols, maybe the symbol of protest and resistance, was the clenched fist raised high in the air. Now, though, more often than not, that fist has a smartphone in it. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports on the modern uses of this tool.
A somber demonstration outside the White House this weekend. People held up signs saying Black Lives Matter, and lots of people also held up their smartphones. One was even aimed at me as I spoke to one of the organizers, Reverend Gregory Drumright.
Society has a body camera.
Reverend Drumright says smartphones have become a tool for justice, especially now since people can broadcast live.
It's not just me that's watching. The whole world is watching what I see.
The whole world watched with Diamond Reynolds in Minnesota. Just moments after her boyfriend was shot by a police officer, she hit record.
They threw my phone, Facebook. Please don't tell me, Lord Jesus, please don't tell me.
It is a level of symbolism, right, that's supposed to say, I can watch you and I have a voice, right? I have my own media platform.
Leah Wright-Rigor at Harvard University says those platforms and the tech companies that run them are struggling to adapt. Wright-Rigor says they're trying to limit negative content, but still leave space for expression.
What we've seen is that most of these major technology corporations have acknowledged that they can be used to document when injustice happens.
And Imani Perry at Princeton says activism has always been quick to embrace technology, whether it's the telegraph or the mimeograph.
Whatever technology has been available, people have tried to use technology as a mechanism for organizing themselves, but also for seeking freedom and equity.
I actually found out about the protests on Facebook. I follow Black Lives DC, and I saw that they had like a link in it. Led me to the protests online.
Back in D.C., Erica England is headed to that demonstration at the White House. She's 25 and a student at Howard University. And when she bought her phone with its pink sparkly case, she never thought this is how she'd use it.
I really thought it would just be mostly like things that don't really matter, like posting pictures, selfies. But now it's important to have a smartphone. It can mean like life or death.
Now she says it's not so frivolous. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A gallon of regular grade gasoline is going to cost you $2.29 this week. That's a national average, of course. Lots of supply. Oil is relatively cheap. You know the formula. But our economy being the interdependent beast that it is, when gas goes down, other things happen. To mass transit, for instance, as gas prices have fallen, so too has ridership on trains and buses. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
One way to figure out what happens to public transit when gas prices fall, analyze consumers' credit and debit card bills. That's what Deanna Farrell did. She's president and CEO of the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, a separate research arm of the bank. And she found,
for every dollar saved from lower gas prices at the pump, households decreased their spending on transit by some 14 cents.
Farrell is co-author of a study that analyzed the bills of a million Chase customers in 23 states. Public transit ridership had been climbing steadily. It did fall a bit last year, along with gas prices. How much of that was due to people driving because gas was cheaper?
The exact effect on transportation is a little bit unknown.
That's Robert Puentes, president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. He says there does seem to be a tipping point.
When it's over $3 per gallon, then we do see riders starting to make those shifts, probably giving up driving because the threshold is too high.
Puentes says there are other things pushing people away from public transportation. Metro systems like the one I ride in Washington are struggling with crumbling infrastructure, and transit systems suffer when riders stay away. Eric Sundquist is managing director of the State Smart Transportation Initiative at the University of Wisconsin.
If it gets bad enough, they have to cut service, raise fares.
Sundquist says the biggest transit systems, like MyMetro, rely the most on passenger fares for revenue, which they need to fix up that creaky infrastructure. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
He tours the world signing soup ladles and saying no soup for you to people.
You've seen that episode, right? The Seinfeld economy straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Brexit, schmexit, yo. Record highs today. The Dow Industrial's up 80 points, 0.4%, 18,226 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 31 points, 0.6%, 49.88. The S&P 500 up 7 points, 0.3%, 2,137, the number there. Mobile gaming companies did all right today. Electronic Arts, gotta love that Plants vs. Zombies thing. It rose 0.1%. Activision, Call of Duty, among others, up 0.2%. Today, shares of aircraft makers Boeing and Airbus took off today after billions of dollars of plane sales were announced at the Farnsworth Air Show, the Uber Plane Fest over in the UK. Boeing lifted 1.5%, Airbus 2.4%. To the higher. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.43%. Kind of an underwhelming number, if you ask me. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are fads, there are crazes, and then there is Pokemon Go. The game has become the top-downloaded, top-grossing app in the United States, New Zealand, and Australia in just the past couple of days since it was released. Nintendo shares are up 25%, and the thing's not even out yet in Europe and Japan. You play on your smartphone outside while Nintendo counts its money. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore in New York explains the hype.
If you're not playing Pokemon Go right now, someone near you probably is. Look for someone frozen, holding their phone up in front of their face, sliding their fingers wildly.
Excuse me, sir. Are you playing Pokemon Go?
I just started doing it.
So it looks like Jay Allen Sub is pointing his phone at empty space, but when he looks through his screen,
there's a monster there.
Okay.
And you could approach it and try to catch the monster.
In this case, it's some kind of cartoon pigeon monster superimposed on the video. He found it on a map in his phone and walked a couple blocks to where it was hiding. Then he threw a digital ball at it.
And now I have the monster.
And that is, so what's fun about that?
Well, you need to collect monsters.
That's really kind of it. You can make your monsters fight other monsters too.
I went to a party last night though, and almost everyone in the party are doing it.
It's free, but you can buy extra perks. Nintendo's stock is soaring.
People are going so crazy about this because it's a confluence of factors, like right time, right place, right thing.
Julie Osk is principal analyst at Forrester Research.
On one hand, they're tapping into the nostalgia of the millennials who spend a lot of time on their mobile phones. It's inherently social.
And it takes advantage of all the things that smartphones can do. Mapping, video, geolocating, says Christine Arrington, senior analyst at IHS.
We haven't seen a lot of games, I think, that really take advantage of that. Really getting people out, walking around, they're out of their homes.
People have kayaked into the middle of a bay to find monsters. They've walked into the street, and they've even been lured into robberies just to catch them all. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
In the most recent edition of our Marketplace Edison Research poll, it's the third installment, by the way, we asked people what they think has caused the loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States. And a majority of people blamed trade deals over other more organic changes to the economy. The reality, though, is that there's a whole mess of things that have caused manufacturing's decline. Automation and technology, for one, global competition in general, the rise of the rest, and yes, also trade agreements. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson drilled down in onto one industry that's been dramatically reshaped by those forces, American textile manufacturers, to see how things played out.
Gloria Craven has seen lots of politicians come through North Carolina.
I met John Edwards. Elizabeth Dole come in.
And the biggest of them all, she pulls a stack of photos of then-candidate Barack Obama out of a plastic bag on the floor by her couch.
That's 2008, didn't have that gray hair yet.
Gloria introduced him at a campaign rally in North Carolina, and then she got a call. Would she like to come to the Democratic National Convention in Denver?
Please welcome Gloria Craven of North Carolina.
So what did you say?
How our town had lost all their textiles and how many people lost jobs.
Textiles. That is why Gloria gets all this attention. She worked in the textile industry for 30 years, her husband for 41.
Well, I worked with bedspreads, then we made blankets.
Twice the mill she worked for closed. She transferred to another division until the whole company shut down for good in 2003. It was the largest layoff in North Carolina history.
It's just hard. I mean, in this town, we basically, when you come out of high school, you went into mills.
The basic cloth Gloria was making and other commodity textiles, say denim, are really easy to make, and so they were really vulnerable to global competition, especially after the Asian currency crisis of the late 90s. The value of Asian currencies plummeted, which made their already cheap stuff even cheaper. Augie Tantillo is the president and CEO of the National Council of Textile Organizations.
It was desperate times. If you looked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics information on a monthly basis, better have your Prozac, because it was depressing. 10,000 jobs lost in the U.S. textile sector, 8,000 jobs the next month, and you don't know when the runaway train is going to come to a stop.
And Tantillo says, yeah, U.S. trade policy has hurt too. There was the phasing out of quotas that limited how much countries could export to the U.S. each year, plus China getting more access to U.S. markets as it joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. Tantillo says the textile industry now employs about half the workers it once did. But he thinks out of all of that pain came a stronger, more specialized industry. His group actually now supports a big pending trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Many American textile companies still make apparel fabrics, but maybe the fabric stretches further or wicks moisture better, or maybe it has a totally new, different application.
We use textile products in all types of construction, filtration for water, for temporary storage devices.
U.S. companies have had to diversify to find their niche, often with really high-tech production. Technology is another thing that's dramatically reshaped this industry and its workforce.
About 20 years ago in this industry, all of this was a manual operation.
Randy Blackston is in Anderson, South Carolina, in front of a machine that swaps out a long row of bobbins, fat with thread, for skinny, empty spools. Dozens of arms moving in unison. He's VP of Operations for Glen Raven, a U.S. textile company that dates back to 1880. We stop in front of a brand new machine still being installed in this immaculate 1 million square foot plant.
So how much would something like this cost?
That one machine's $1 million.
A big investment. But in textiles, competitors are always chasing you. In the 90s, 80% of what Glen Raven made was apparel fabrics. But they looked at the market and decided they needed to specialize. Now its biggest product line is this fade-resistant, super durable fabric called Sombrella. It's used in awnings, the roof of convertible cars, furniture.
The most successful producers in the U.S. were those that, to use a term we get from our entrepreneurship people, they pivoted.
Patrick Conway is an econ professor at UNC Chapel Hill.
Rather than saying we're going to produce large quantities of denim fabric, they said, well, let's look at what we do best. Let's exploit our comparative advantage.
That term right there, that's something you might remember if you took Econ 101. It's the idea that countries should specialize in what they're good at relative to other countries and trade for the rest.
We can all be made better off. In the end, the outcome are the lower cost goods and services that we're able to buy at any of our large stores.
In other words, Conway says what happened to the textile industry is sort of how trade is supposed to work.
That's exactly the idea.
But Conway says that doesn't mean the transformation isn't painful. And it's not quite a perfect textbook system. In theory, laid-off workers would get new jobs in other parts of the economy. In practice, recent research shows that's been really hard and slow. Some may have to take lower-paying jobs. Others may drop out of the workforce altogether. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
You can see the rest of our stories from this round of polling and take our quiz and see how you measure up on our Economic Anxiety Index at marketplace.org. Imagine, if you can, a television show, a crazy smash hit, iconic television show that was, and they were very upfront about this, it was about nothing. This was back in the days when TV was TV, appointment viewing. And I'm talking here about Seinfeld, the brainchild of Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld. And it is also the subject of a new book called Seinfeldia by Jennifer Keshen Armstrong. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Who were, just as a starting point, who were Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld before Seinfeld?
They were comedians, and that's it. And they thought, like, you know, we're funny when we talk. That's also very them, you know. It's all about pure comedy.
They had some pushback from the network, right, and from the gatekeepers, I guess?
Yeah, you know, it was not like a huge blockbuster pitch out of the gate, that's for sure. The network people would often see a show and they'd be like, well, we like it, but we don't think America will, because they think they're different from America. So it was definitely a very slow start. They were on the air for one episode in July, 1 year. That was 89. Then they were on four episodes the next summer, and then 13, I believe, and then the next year they were finally on for a full season. So it was a slow start.
But here we are 25-something years later, which, oh, my God. And this franchise, I guess you'd call it a Seinfeld economy built up around this thing. I mean, you know, people who were in it or associated with it give tours in New York. Hulu, for crying out loud, spent $160 million to help it compete against Netflix and Amazon. I mean, it's the nub of a whole lot of things.
Yes. My favorite, the soup Nazi, the guy who played the soup Nazi, which most people don't realize he was in one episode. He still makes his living doing appearances as the soup Nazi. He tours the world signing soup ladles like that and saying no soup for you to people. And that's it. And it's, you know, he does this mainly because, I guess, you know, he can handle it psychologically. He seems okay with it, but it's crazy.
And people pay him.
Just
to bring it present day, Larry David is, of course, Larry David, and he's doing Bernie Sanders imitations, and he's got a show and this and that. And Seinfeld is on the internet with comedians in cars getting coffee. So, I mean, you know, they're staying busy, right?
Yeah, they seem like the kind of guys, I love this about them. They seem like the kind of guys who just love what they do. I mean, I think comedians in cars is great.
Yeah.
And it once again goes back to a comedian talking to a comedian.
Right.
And, you know, and adding cars and coffee, which he also apparently likes. So
can we talk now before I let you go about the series finale?
Yes.
I think it was the worst series finale in the history of television ever. Discuss.
See, I'm a defender.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah,
oh,
I understand.
It was such a cop-out.
I understand.
Let's
I
go
understand
to jail. You know, whatever.
Many of the objections to it. I've become a defender in rewatch. What I admire about it is that it tried something. You know, it didn't have Jerry and Elaine get married. It didn't, you know, things that a normal. And it's like, here's another way of thinking about it. Like, what would you rather have seen?
Yeah, I don't know. See, the thing is, I saw it and I was so turned off by it that I literally have not gone back to rewatch it. Maybe I should rewatch, as the lingo goes.
Go watch it.
All right. I will go watch and I will send you a note. All right.
All right. Sounds good.
Jennifer Keshen Armstrong, her new book is called Seinfeldia. Weigh in, would you, on Twitter or whatever, about what you think about that finale? Let me know if I'm wrong. Thanks. We'll see you soon.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, which you are going to think I'm making up, but honestly, I'm really not, despite its Monty Python-esque overtones. David Cameron goes out and makes that announcement today about his successor as the Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. In other words, he publicly kisses his political career goodbye. He wraps up the statement, he turns around, he walks back into number 10 Downing Street, but somebody forgot to turn off the lavalier microphone that he was wearing. This is what happened next.
Right.
That's enough. Pip, pip, cheerio. Right. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 80 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 31.6%. The S&P 500 up 7.3% there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.